What's up, y'all? Welcome back to Rebel Radio. My guest today, Gabriel Garcon Montano, is a neo-soul artist who's blowing up quickly after being sampled by Drake, going on tour with Lenny Kravitz. And he gives us some pretty interesting insights into the inner dialogue of an artist. For a young guy, he kind of has a lot figured out as far as his, what he calls his mission statement, knowing when it's time to step up his game, and not listening to the critics, especially himself. So tune in and let us know what you think. Rebel Radio is brought to you in partnership with EDM.com, the world's leading curator for all things electronic dance music. If you haven't been over to EDM.com, check it out. I think you're pretty much guaranteed to find some music you'll like, even if you're not into EDM. They have so many different styles. There's hip-hop. There's all kinds of things that you wouldn't think of as dance music, but some really good music there. And this week's track of the week from EDM.com is from Helene. The song is called King of Thieves, and it is a mellow, sexy groove. So check it out. Welcome back. We're here on Rebel Radio, the podcast where we talk about the art of selling without selling out. We talk to artists on the bubble about to blow up, and I think we have a great guest in studio today, Gabriel Garcon Montano. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. I got to see you last night at Hotel Cafe, and it was an amazing show. For anyone listening who's not familiar with Gabriel, Gabriel was a Red Bull Sound Select artist. I think we're going to talk a little bit about that. He's been on tour with Lenny Kravitz, and one of his tracks was sampled by Drake, and it feels like there's a lot of good stories that you're experiencing so far already. I will say, you know, I've been listening to the music, and I found you through your management. So Josh and Jackson are good friends. They're part of the extended family. We do a lot of work with them. And when they told me about you and shared the SoundCloud, I was interested. I liked the music. I got to say, seeing it last night took it to a whole new level, and I really got a lot of dimension about you that I hadn't heard in the recordings. And so I'm curious sort of how it's different for you, you know, live versus recorded.
Mm-hmm. I made the record in 2012, so I was a different musician.
Sure.
I had different vocal abilities. And playing the songs for 3 years, you just kind of start doing them a new way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every once in a while, I'll listen to the record, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Right. And, yeah, that's cool.
And, yeah, I'm out of the mind that you have to go back and try to, like, fit yourself into what that sounds like. You just, this is me singing the song today, and tomorrow I'll do it another way. Well, I mean, you know, not on purpose, but sure. You evolve.
No, I think the recordings are good. They're just different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got, when I first was listening, you know, I got a lot of Omar vibe. The singer Omar. You're familiar with him?
He's an R&B?
Yeah, kind of R&B, neo-soul, British guy.
Okay. When you were listening to the record?
When I listened to the record. There's nothing like this. Last night, I got a lot of Prince, a lot of D'Angelo, and I think a lot of that was the intensity that, you know, the neo soul in general, I think is a very restrained genre. where there's a lot of just really easygoing, you know, it's almost like easy listening, which I think you could say that about R&B in general to some extent. Obviously, there's exceptions to that, but on stage, there was just a ton of passion. I want to talk about the drummer a little bit because it was just you and the drummer.
Yeah.
And what he was doing with the sounds and effects was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So how do you put a show like that together?
Well, for the most part, it's the drum stems when they're not when it's not an actual piece of the drum kit. I just took the stems and put them on the pad so that you can get the aesthetic of the record.
Yeah.
And then anything that's outside of what's on the record, it just sounds we like. And we're just playing the songs down. Sometimes we have little interludes that we go into.
Yeah.
And stuff like that is born on stage usually. Rehearsals just rehearsals always like a recap of you know stuff that has happened. Usually on stage the vibe is way better than at rehearsal.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Rehearsal studios I haven't found ones with really great sound and
oh really?
Live everyone has their own monitor, you know, it feels nice and so it gives you a platform to like kind of get lifted on.
So I mentioned the influences I heard. Am I right there? Are there other influences?
Yeah. I mean, Prince and D'Angelo loom very large in my life. I love them.
What was the first Prince record that you
It was Sign of the Times, the second disc, actually.
Okay. And any song in particular?
I think If I Was Your Girlfriend is the second track, and that was the first one that my mother's boyfriend at the time, I was 15, he asked me to do him the favor of cleaning his studio floors. And so he said, do a square foot per song and just scrub that one square foot once the song is over and then move to the next one. And then he said, I'm going to put this record on for you. And then he said, I built houses to this shit.
And then, no kidding.
And then someone around.
That's dope.
Came on and it was really weird contextually at 15 to hear that.
Sure.
Because I didn't know that his voice was that he did vary speed on his voice, which is he slows down the track and then sings it, and then everything gets sped back up, which is a common practice. Or also just taking your master and speeding it up at the end just to get it tighter, to get your vocal a little more. A lot of people do it. That's why it's sometimes with old records you try to learn them on the piano and they're like in between two notes. Anyway, the sound of his voice, it was just like, it was really funky and like really, he was really in there, but just the way he sounded so different than other men was like really freaky to me.
Yeah.
But I was really intrigued because like I could tell how great it was, but it just kind of disturbed me, gave me the shivers.
Is that right?
Yeah, but then I listened to that for a week, just Sign of the Times, one song at a time with like this meditative scrubbing the floor.
Wow.
And by the end, I was just in love with it.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
My Prince experience a little different. I was 10, and Dirty Mind was out, and it was big in my school. And my grandparents took me on a cruise. We're in Mexico on this cruise, and in the bottom of the cruise ship was a disco, and so I go down there at 10 o'clock at night or whatever. And I'm a 10-year-old in this disco, and he's playing. Actually, I remember he was playing Physical by Olivia Newton-John. And I walk up to the DJ. I'm like, hey, man, can you play Head? And by Prince. And the guy looks at me and goes, who's Prince? And I just walked away. Like I'm sure he's like, who the fuck is this 10-year-old
that's
bothering
awesome.
Me, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, that was so. That was the beginning of my Prince career.
First Prince song that I covered, it was with my funk band.
Oh, really?
When I was 19. Yeah.
So, tell us about the band before. What were you doing before this?
Well, starting like 12, I wrote like some kiddie songs, and I was like really into Nirvana.
Mm.
So they had like clean kind of somber verses, and then in the chorus I would like start screaming, and the distortion would come on. Wow. Kind of like Smells Like Teen Spirit, that formula.
Sure.
And then came out of that, and then 15 was like singer songwriting, listening to a lot of Jeff Buckley and Radiohead and the Beatles. And that got kind of depressing, playing in cafes, just kind of like my sad songs, whatever, and not having a mastery over arrangements and just feeling like it was all just chord. Like, I felt like there's so many people who do that. So, mm-hmm. And then getting into R&B music and funk music with all the arranging.
Yeah.
Was my way kind of out. So I started just binge listening and like really investigating, and then put together a group that ended up in its final incarnation was like four horns, three singers, myself, a guitar player, keyboard, bass, and drums. And I wrote all the music and did all the arrangements, transcribing like Sign of the Family Stone,
mm-hmm.
all the stuff from Fresh, Stand, Life, Earth, Wind, and Fire, P-Funk, James, Kool and the Gang, and writing all the horn charts and figuring out who was playing what notes and like how this stuff was woven together gave me like this whole three-dimensional outlook on an arrangement.
Yeah.
So then I kind of brought some of that back to then my songwriting in earnest, which is kind of what you have now.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today to be available for you to see. I'm about to go, and then you'll know for me to stay, I got to be me. You'll never be.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw some of that last night. Definitely that. At the end, the distortion and kind of, you know, got heavier through the set, which mm-hmm. is pretty cool. So did you, at what point did you realize that you wanted to be a musician as a career?
I remember one time when I think I was like 9 years old when it dawned on me that you had to work to live,
mm-hmm.
and you had to make money. I was like, oh no, my life isn't just going to be going to the park or doing whatever.
I'm still realizing that.
Yeah, me too. It's been pretty hard. And I was like, okay, well, what would I do to get money? And then I rattled off like the tropes that are handed down: astronaut, policeman, fireman, doctor, sure. veterinarian. And my mom's a musician. So I was like, I think I would do that.
What kind of music she'd make?
Vocalist, multi-instrumentalist. She sang with the Philip Glass Ensemble, New York City Opera, the chorus. So classical music, Brazilian music, a lot of old music.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's cool. So, and then you studied.
Yep.
Formal music training.
Yeah, I did Suzuki violin, mm-hmm. which is all by ear. You're given sheet music just to follow along to, not specifically to sight read from.
Mm-hmm.
You learn it from your teacher showing you. And then when you're at home, you look at the sheet music to guide you. So did that, the violin from like 6 to 13, and then kind of self-taught drumming and guitar and rock and roll vibes.
Nice.
And I got really into drums. I went to LaGuardia High School for drums, and I had like a double kick drum pedal and splash cymbals, and I was doing like the whole fusion thing, like the wannabe fusion thing.
Sure.
And then SUNY Purchase, studio composition, mm-hmm. songwriting with an emphasis on like a little bit of production and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So in that, what's been a piece of some feedback or criticism you've gotten that like stung, you know, but you knew it was true?
When? Throughout the years?
Yeah. So anything that stands out?
Well, Henry Hirsch, who I made my record with,
mm-hmm.
he's been one of my foremost mentors. When I was 15, we started working together, and he would have me record drums and then A-B me with John Bonham, A-B my vocals with Jeff Buckley's.
Wow.
And he'd be like, this is you. This is John. You're not a real drummer. This is you. This is Jeff. And so he showed me like where I was at and where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
And I would cry straight up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Our producer, Cassandra, is not here. She's in New York, but I went over questions with her this morning, and she told me all my questions sucked. And so we rewrote them, and she wanted me to ask you about what someone had said that made you cry. And I said, I'm not going to ask. We're two guys, we're not going to sit around. I'm not going to ask that. But I'm glad you bring that up.
Yeah.
She'll be happy to hear.
In recent times, I haven't really heard anything.
Yeah.
In fact, more recently, I've been the one who to say I think I suck. And people go, no, it's great.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't understand that idea of being your own worst critic, right? That there is a value to that. I mean, it can obviously shut you down if it's not balanced. But, you know, I think we see, especially in music, a lot of people that don't take that criticism seriously enough, especially coming from within, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different reasons people get into making pop music.
Yours?
Mine? Because I love music. Mm-hmm. And because I can sing and I can do the other stuff, and so I have a mind for putting it together.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that a little. I read an interview talking about the Drake sample, and you used an interesting phrase that you and he have very different mission statements.
Mm.
So how would you describe your mission statement for what you're doing?
My mission statement, I guess, well, included in it would be that it's to make beautiful music that is healing, and that at no point in any way is at anybody's expense. So I would never put out a message that was derogatory in an attempt to align myself with a certain pop tradition or a certain acceptance into a, I feel like there's certain things that you can say that make you more prone to being played at, you know, to being in the pantheon of like party artists or people who are relevant in a very like culturally relevant now today,
you know,
and a lot of that includes like, I don't know, forgoing human dignity, especially with women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and just kind of acting like it's cool to be shallow in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't take away from any of these great artists, but a lot of them, they have a lot of points like that. Yeah. And if you don't do that, you get labeled as a backpack or like conscious or like soft or something.
Yeah.
And so I want to accept the challenge of not stooping low. And then musically, I'm not really trying to align myself with what I'm hearing, in all these different formats and these like avenues that you can set out to make music in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to do something I've never heard before.
Rock me real slowly.
I noticed that you're playing for different crowds, you know, last night at Hotel Cafe, playing with Glass Animals, being on tour with Lenny. I saw there was a Matt Deason show you played. So very different audiences. So how does that work? Like, what do you do when the crowd's not feeling it?
Keep playing.
Just keep.
There's very little I can do to change
what
I'm doing. Because that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. So when you played for Matt Deason, did they get it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like the staff of Matt Deason or anybody
who
represents like that style. All sorts of artists were playing on that bill. And you know, that was at South by Southwest. So anybody's going to be there or nobody. That was actually a very poorly attended show.
Was it?
Yeah. And most of the people in the crowd were people that liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's part of being a musician today where, you know, traditionally things were much more divided around genre lines.
Mm.
And there was a much better chance that, you know, if you're opening for someone, you sound pretty close to what that guy is going to sound like in the past. Mm-hmm. I think today that's very different, obviously, with festival culture, that, you know, you're playing for a much more diverse audience who has, you know, whole different sets of tastes and not just sonically, but the energy and the vibe that they're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can still look back, though, and see examples. Like, we were at the Fillmore on Sunday, and I saw Miles Davis opening for the Grateful Dead, you know?
Yeah.
And when I was on the road with Lenny, I asked him what his first big tour was, so I could kind of wrap my head around what it must have been like for him.
Yeah.
And his first big tour was with Tom Petty.
Oh, wow.
And that's pretty different.
Yeah.
Especially on the record he was touring on, where his Let Love Rule is a very dry record. It's not a lot of reverb. Funky, you know, a little bit psychedelic. And then Tom Petty, you know, it's like a kind of like a middle-of-the-road pop powerhouse.
Yeah.
And then after that, he did Bowie and Bob Dylan. And so on the next records, Lenny's playing more like funky stadium rock music, but still funky, Led Zeppelin inspired. Yeah. So the contrast with Bob Dylan must have been, I was imagining he must have played him off the stage.
Sure.
But not really because of the legend, you know. And
yeah, people were there to see
the stature of these other artists, yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading Herbie Hancock's autobiography, and he talks about the Mwandishi band, which was his like Afro period that he went through, this really like psychedelic soul thing he was doing, and he got booked to open in Central Park for Iron Butterfly. And like he said, you know, they were up there, he was used to being Herbie Hancock and playing with Miles Davis, and all of a sudden they were up there, nobody got it. And kind of like you said, you just power through it, you just play.
Yeah, because if
you're there to play.
Yeah, if you're gonna go around changing what you do based on how people react, then you're never really gonna fulfill your mission. You're just gonna end up kind of diluted.
So when you're out with Lenny, well, I'm curious, what did he do that surprised you?
I don't know. I can't say that he surprised me very much. I definitely.
And did you anything about him?
I didn't have a preconceived. I didn't really set out to think what he would be doing.
Okay.
You mean on stage?
Yeah, just
or in general.
In general. Any surprises with that?
No surprises. What I can say is that, you know, he very disciplined in terms of, you know, not partying, not drinking, not smoking. No alcohol in his personal rider. Just drinking water little sips at a time, personal steam inhaler, humidifier in the room, work out before the show, running around the arena.
Wow. What do you think he taught you?
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And take care of yourself.
Take care of yourself and don't, you know.
Yeah.
20 years down the road, it's not like, as interesting as it seems, it's like, yeah, playing to 10,000 people who it looks like would kill for you, loses, I'm sure, some of the thrill, and you realize that a lot is riding on your back, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a job.
You have a 50-person crew.
Right.
Whose salaries you're paying, and the show must go on, so you got to really take care of yourself, because there's nobody else who can get up there and sing the words that you have to sing. So, like, he has to really protect that. And he had laryngitis on the tour.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So he was like really, he's playing on a broken leg. That's what he said.
Wow.
But yeah, so just the ability to like really be within yourself and not to let excitement kind of like distract you and take you outside of like your intention. That was huge.
Yeah.
Because I had so much adrenaline on the road that I had to take it out somehow. It was just like.
So did you take it out on stage?
To be an artist at this point. Going from playing to 200 people at most to playing in front of 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 people. It was just like an energy injection that like I didn't really know how to handle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that change things for you? You get back to New York after the tour, you know, you get up the next morning and like, does it feel like the world is different for you what does that do in your brain?
I think in my brain, it just brought to mind that now is the time to be world class. That's all I could think of.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering whether I was and what I could do better.
So one of the themes that we want to explore is about fame and success and how that happens. And I think, you know, we talk about, culturally, we talk about the Justin Biebers who were not famous one day and the next day they were. But for most people, that's not what happens, right? It happens in small steps that build cumulatively.
Mm.
And I'm curious, and I, you know, I think we're seeing that with you, right? That you've had these milestones at this point in your career. So I wonder how much you notice those. Like, how much do you notice that? Is there a day you wake up that's like, where I am today is different than where I was yesterday?
I think the most noticeable thing is in terms of like people in my age group, my peers,
mm-hmm.
and the way they regard me or address me based on what they see online.
Yeah.
Which is now how people find out about each other's lives.
What's an example?
People seeing people seeing things in the world, but also on Instagram, seeing what maybe my touring schedule is, or you know, or whenever something's posted online about things that are happening,
mm-hmm.
Then people start imagining what your life must be like or something, and then when they call you or text you or to congratulate you, or when all you're getting is just texts of people congratulating you and nothing else,
right? You know? How does that feel?
It feels cool, but then after a while, it loses its immediate value, and it becomes a gesture that you recognize from afar,
mm-hmm.
and so it loses all of its value and mm-hmm. becomes an empty gesture.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And so then when most of your interactions with people become, oh, congrats on Drake or congrats on this, then after a while, you miss the diversity of the interactions you used to have.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why you have family, and that's why you have good friends, and it's not like it's to a crazy degree for me. I still feel very, very chill.
Yeah, yeah. But I imagine that changes over time. That gets harder and harder to filter out, and I think that's, you can see how people become jaded in that situation, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mostly people have been going, yo, you've been killing it. Congrats. Congrats on everything. Mm-hmm. That's a phrase that I hear a lot. And so depending on what kind of day I'm having, sometimes it works, like it has an adverse effect on me when I don't feel like I'm personally killing it in my day-to-day life.
Yeah, that maybe it makes you feel disconnected from people because they don't get it.
You know, I've been calling my dad a lot more lately and spending a lot more time with my dad. I think that's definitely something I could speak to.
So how does that help?
He knows me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we have a space together that nothing really enters into. There's no judgment. I haven't appreciated in value given things that I've done in the world. It's just what it is. It's a relationship of pure love.
Yeah, I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Keep you anchored.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Because at first, you know, when exciting things are happening, your mind does all these somersaults, and you just kind of get to the point where you're excited for no reason, and then you have to, like, come down and be like, okay, let me get back to work, and let me, like, you know. Because there was a time when the only consideration was just purely, like, the investigation and the execution of making music.
Mm-hmm.
Which it still is now, but then now it's like, oh, like, X amount of people will hear this as soon as I put it out.
Right.
Even though it's not a great number, it's still, it changes a little bit.
Yeah.
And then you have to analyze how your mind behaves.
Yeah.
How it reacts to certain thoughts. And ultimately all that has to be out the window because it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're being appreciated for something that was made in a vacuum when there was no expectation and when nobody cared to find out what you were doing, then that's probably how you should always make it.
Yeah, I mean,
or you can feed off of it and make it a positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ride the energy.
Yeah, although I think you're right that more often than not it becomes a distraction and it becomes, I mean, I think that's why there are so many one-hit wonders.
Mm.
Because you've created something in one set of, you're in one set of life circumstances, and then after that, you're in a completely different situation, and the pressure and the opportunities and the, like, your world has completely changed, and then you're expected to go create again, but you're a different person now.
Right. And I think from afar, what I can see is that perhaps the daily discipline, leaving the routine, is probably paves the way for that kind of artistic disintegration.
Yeah.
Or maybe that the fact that you know, you're not really meant to do it in the first place, and that you happened upon a set of sounds that really worked for that moment.
Yeah, could be. So talk about your team a little bit, because I think, you know, again, I mentioned, you know, I'm a big fan of your management, and but I think that relationship is really special and important, and I think probably a lot of people choose, you know, the wrong team for the wrong reasons. And so, you know, I'm curious to know how that dynamic works for you, in the sense of, you know, do you have a vision and then your managers are responsible for them for executing that? Are you creating that together? Do they have a vision for you? How's that work?
I think right now the focus is just to get the music to the right people, or to people at all. So just to increase the number of people who are, you know, seeing me on stage or listening to me.
Yeah.
And beyond that, in order to really execute an artistic vision, you need the means. And so in a time of intense investment, which the last 5 years have been for me, I don't really have that much to play with in terms of like a vision of what my stage show looks like, of actually having the correct amount of people to play the arrangements and to sing with me and to really make it, you know, what I know it's going to be.
Yeah.
Which is like maybe 7-8 people on stage all singing and playing and like, and rehearsing, you know, every day for hours and hours. Like once you can pay people and have the facilities and all that.
Sure.
That's my vision. Is musical excellence and just to deliver, which I have before with my funk band we had. It felt much more like that because, you know, it was a lot of us and it was very tightly orchestrated.
Yeah. So on that vision, I mentioned before you've done Red Bull Sound Select. So talk about that a little bit and about how, you know, I'm curious sort of what that program meant to you. And I'm curious where the where you see brand relationships playing a role in what you do.
Very simply put, I think what Red Bull does is what, you know, less and less labels are doing now, which is just putting the money down.
Yeah.
And so given the capital that they're allowed to play with and invest ultimately in themselves and their brand, but through putting on young artists, it just gives you the opportunity to experience a level of, you know, of exposure or smooth operation that you wouldn't otherwise given your current situation.
I want to go back to the music a little bit, and I know we talked about Prince and D'Angelo. One of the things that I feel like your music is very sexual, that it's sort of dripping with that. Is that part of how you create?
I think that my fascinations with different grooves and feels translate that way to people. When I hear people say that smooth and sexy, it's hilarious to me. Especially when if there were videos of me recording the music, when you see like what that looks like, it's just this intense focus and probably not the most, you know, me playing drums like,
sure,
like trying to get it right.
So
that's funny to me, but I understand how that would, I think the music I listen to, the special attention to groove, and then just like the different ingredients, the keyboards, I think give that feeling to people.
Yeah.
certain types of harmony.
Yeah.
But you know what? There's a new song that's pretty sexual. Crawl is very sexual in the lyrics. Because I was thinking back to the EP. There's nothing even. Oh no, 6-8 has a sexual tension to it.
Yeah, I definitely took that from 6-8.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Yeah.
So what do you listen to in those moments? Do you have a go-to?
Oh, if I can draw influences back.
No, like, is there lovemaking music for you? Do you listen to your own music? Just kidding.
No. Oh, well, no. That would be fucked up.
That would be weird.
Let's
Don't
see.
Do that, kids.
Yeah, like Sara, Outkast, Slum Village. Yeah, I guess things that are funkier, smoother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I think, you know, we can hear some of that.
I definitely wouldn't listen to Neil Young while making love. Let's put it that way.
Some people would.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to see you dance again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, different strokes, right?
Yeah, I mean, once you get up there into your 50s and 60s.
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting phenomenon that people's musical taste locks in, typically, at a certain stage in life. And, you know, it's usually like whatever your high school or college music was, you kind of stick
with
that. Yeah,
it's based on like forever. Your coming of age a little bit.
Yeah.
Sure.
Do you keep up with new music? Is that...
Me?
Yeah.
I'm very bad at it.
Anybody you're checking for?
The last two records I listened to all the way through were Black Messiah and To Pimp a Butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Probably pretty predictable choices for me. But those are the type of artists I value.
Mm-hmm.
As a musician, it's hard to like be convinced by marketing or by image, especially when you like spend all your time doing music. It's like,
sure.
You're, you know, so that's really... That's what I've been checking out.
Mm-hmm. When you write, is there a person? Is there? Are you writing for somebody?
I think in part I'm writing for the respect of like my favorite musicians. But that would be. That's like maybe my third consideration down the list. I'm writing for me.
Yeah.
I'm writing to interest myself. To create something in my life that is like exciting.
Yeah.
That takes me away from like all the mundane activities.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about musical influences. I know, you know, I've seen some interviews where you talked about literature as well.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about some non-musical influences and how does that work?
I'm a pretty visual person, so I was looking through my notes. I don't know if I still have it, but I was at a museum and I was like, oh, okay, your music needs to be the musical equivalent of this painter, for example, and just however my mind associates the two kind of like two ideas that any different person is gonna have a different way of relating the color pink to a sound.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they do have spectrums for all these things.
Sure.
So stuff like that, just to prompt a kind of like a signal in your brain that maybe you haven't. Just
yeah.
New muscles. Yeah. So like painters and then, yeah, poets. Poets, they there's more of a direct line there because of the lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Is there a process when you're getting ready to write or to create music? Do you go to a museum? Is there like some process you go through to get that inspiration?
No, I would just say that anything like that that's happening in my life will find its way in there.
Yeah.
But sometimes I've gone on walks or I went to the botanical gardens just because I had nothing, no ideas.
Sure.
But I think learning other people's music is a great way to get that started.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Learning something you don't know.
Right.
Because then you have a new piece of language.
Yeah. Do you find that doing that then Like, I've heard people say that they don't, you know, they don't want to listen to other music while they're creating. Because maybe it directs them too much. Do you find that, or are you able to distance?
Yeah, just in general, because like, you know, the food you eat makes you look and feel the way you feel and look. And I think it's the same with music, you know, or anything. The shows you watch, the things you read, the things you talk about, the emotions that you allow yourself to feel, they pretty much shape your experience.
Mm-hmm.
So after a while, if you just watch TV all the time, then you're not really going to have very interesting thoughts.
Right.
Because all these commercials are designed by psychologists, and it's like based on very deep-seated insight into the human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And it's designed to make you feel uninspired and inferior so that you buy things.
Yeah.
So, or just watching stupid TV shows where all you're seeing is like petty human interactions or like jealousy, anger, you know, then you're not gonna be able to come from a place of like compassion or just being within yourself, like being spontaneous. You're just gonna be more by the books.
Is there good TV in your mind? Like, are there any shows?
I love Cosmos.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
I love Cosmos.
Yeah.
Visually it's super stimulating, and then
yeah,
it's really interesting.
Well, yeah, that's a great example, I think, because it takes a, you know, pretty heady sort of non-TV topic and doesn't dumb it down, but makes it relatable, which is, I think, maybe a good metaphor for what good music can do, too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Make it feel good.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nice, man. Well, thanks for joining us on the show. I hope you'll come back next time you're in town.
I will.
And we will be checking for you online.
Cool.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hey, subscribe to the show. We're on soundcloud.com/rebel_radio. You can also hit us on Twitter @rebelradionet. And I hope you enjoyed listening. I'm Josh Levine for Rebel Radio. Yeah.